VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Wine Times, brought to you in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. My name is Will Lyons, the Sunday Times wine columnist and vice president of the Sunday Times Wine Club. I'm very excited to bring you a very special bonus episode of the podcast recorded within the hustle and bustle of this year's Vintage Wine Festival at London's Olympia with my fantastic guest, the formidable wine expert, Oz Clark. Oz found his way onto our screens in the 1980s from the hit BBC entertainment show Food and Drink. Since then, Oz has frequented the entertainment industry, appearing on numerous TV shows and radio airwaves. And amongst a plethora of successful broadcasts, Oz has also found the time to publish several books on wine. In the lead up to the Sunday Times Wine Club's 50th anniversary, I can't think of anyone better to clink glasses with. I'm delighted to say that Oz joins me now on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, isn't it?
Jolly nice to be here. This is a wonderful, noisy place you've chosen. Isn't it good, though? The festival is back. And it's obviously back noisier and louder and more enthusiastic than ever.
And we were here, so we're recording this on a Saturday morning, so we were here yesterday. And the buzz last night was unbelievable, wasn't
Brilliant.
It?
Brilliant. Yeah. And this is Saturday morning. It's hardly started yet.
I know. And we're here. And we've had some great discoveries, I think.
Yeah.
So, Oz, what's your sort of impressions of the festival, though? I mean, you and I go to a lot of trade tastings, but it's great to meet the public, isn't it? And hear what they want.
It's so important. Yeah. At trade tastings, we can get into a bubble of our own, surrounded by sommeliers and wine writers and wine importers, all saying, this wine's wonderful, and, oh, they've done this and that, and it's this and that, and it's achieved this and that. And I sometimes sit in the corner thinking, but I'm not getting any buzz out of it. You guys are all going bonkers about it. I don't believe the members of the public will go for it. And I continually, when I'm doing my wine judging, much as I love the intellectual side, I come from BBC Food and Drink. I come from a populist point of view of wanting to spread pleasure. Yeah. And I'm always looking for the hedonism, looking for the joy, the indulgence in the wine. This is what is so good about this wine festival.
Yeah.
It is packed with thousands of people who've got a very similar attitude to that.
I agree. I think Tony Lathwaite once said to me that I started working in shops, so I got into the habit of talking to the public about wine on a basic level and seeing, you know, what they like. But Oz, we go back a while, don't we? I was just thinking about the first time we met. And I was up at Edinburgh University running the Wine Society. I was an undergraduate then. This was... must have been 96 or 97. And Oz came up for a book launch.
Hang on. I think I know what you're going to say. What are you going to say?
In the Cowgate in Edinburgh. So there was a bunch of students, and we probably had a bit too much of your delicious Sauvignon Blanc that you were serving. And not sure all of us paid for the books, actually.
I'm not sure any of you paid. I remember in the Cowgate, was it?
Yeah.
We had a fantastic evening.
Yeah, it was great.
And you were a really wonderfully rowdy lot.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of you paid. And I think I was abetting it. I think I was saying, go on, steal a lot, you know, down the capitalist. And my poor old publisher must be thinking, I'm never taking that bloke out on a book tour again. The evening did not end at the bookstore. I remember hours later being in some strange part of Edinburgh with a bunch of wonderful people having a fantastic party, thinking, I am never going to make my radio broadcast next morning. And I eventually had to walk from somewhere on one side of Edinburgh down to Leith that night. And I got, when my hotel was, and I reckon I got to Leith at 5:30 in the morning.
Oh,
and I had an 8 o'clock Radio Scotland recording, which was one of my worst, I suspect, or one of my best. I think I just said, I've been out all night. And I sound as though I have. Don't ask me anything too difficult. And we got away with it.
It's a great city. It's all steeped in wine. Yeah. And funny enough, I found the book the other day. I still have it. Yeah.
Well, you can pay me now. I take cash.
It must be worth about
well. 9 pence.
Yeah. Well, if you think about inflation, it's probably... That was your little pocket wine book.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I remember that night because you spoke so passionately about New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, and it really stayed with me. And I just wonder where you first sort of caught the wine bug. Where did it all begin for you?
Well, it all began at university, with you probably, because my parents really didn't drink wine. And to be honest, it began with trying to get a girlfriend. I mean, I went out to Oxford full of Max Beerbohm and Evelyn Waugh and thinking, I'm going to live the gilded life of all those heroes. But I had no money.
Yeah.
And I thought, how on earth can I lead the gilded life with no money when lots of people with money around picking off all the girlfriends I was hoping I was going to have? And I discovered there was a wine society. And I looked at it and it said, it was subsidized by the university. You got 4 tastings a term for £2. And I thought, 50 pence a tasting, I'll become an elegant, soigné, sophisticated wine expert. I will be irresistible to the opposite sex. And then in the small print at the bottom, I saw that you could take a guest. And suddenly 50 pence a tasting became 50 pence a date. So my first 4 tastings, I took 4 different girls to. They never spoke to me again, ever, any of them. I remember my first tasting. Her name was Francesca, and she was green from top to bottom. Green hair, green sequins, everything, green body paint. You know, nothing about it which wasn't green. We turned up for this Bordeaux tasting. I was in my jeans and T-shirt. Every single person in the room was in a pinstripe suit.
Even at university? Yeah.
Even at university.
That really is even
more. That was what Bordeaux was like in those days.
Yeah.
And so she went away and all the other girls went away. My social life was absolutely rock bottom. But I did discover the thrill of taste.
Yeah.
And I'd always been brought up with taste because we grew up in the country, self-sufficient, and we'd grow our own vegetables, our own fruit, raised our own chickens and pigs and all that. I was my mother's little helper. I didn't go to school till I was 6.
Yeah.
I think my parents just forgot to send me. And I was, because my mother probably thought, he's much too useful in the garden. Don't send him to school. And so I knew about flavors and smells, and wine brought it to an absolutely new level. The last wine at that Bordeaux tasting, I remember to this day, it was Leovil Barton, 1962. Wow. And the flavor, it said to me, it's as though, you know, the gods of wine had flung a gauntlet of challenge to the floor and said, this is as good as wine can be. Beat that.
Yeah.
And the flavor still lingers in my mind now. The amazing blackcurranty flavor, but so beautifully blackcurranty and yet so dry. It was as though a dragon had sucked all the sweetness out of the blackcurrant. And then it was curled with Havana tobacco smoke and pencil shavings. And you just thought, I've never had anything like this in my life. If this is wine, I'm going to go for it. And my passion was because it seemed that it was something I wanted to be excited. I was excited about, and I wanted to tell people.
Yeah.
And then we had a wine club, like you did. Eventually, we ran wine tastings. And then, of course, we had an English wine tasting team.
Of course you did.
And I was an actor by then.
Yeah.
We had an English wine tasting team, and that was fantastic. We went to the French and the Germans and the Italians and the Americans. We kept beating them.
And you did very well. Yeah, you did very well.
And I got known as the actor who knows about wine. And it all led from there.
Brilliant. Well, look, it's early, but that just that talk about that wonderful Leovil Barton and the texture of it. I think it's time for a glass of wine.
I've been talking far too much. My throat is dry. You've got something exciting for us.
So I was walking around the festival yesterday, and it's a wine I know, but I took some people to this stall. We're heading down to Devon. This is from the Sharpham Estate, so it's on the banks of the River Dart.
I know it.
Just outside of Totnes, sort of Agatha Christie country, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is a Madeleine Angevin. So the grape variety is, again, it's hardly planted in France. I think it's in the...
I'm sure it's banned.
Loire Valley.
I'm sure it'll be banned. I mean, it probably comes from Loire Valley and they banned it 50 years ago. Hang on, which vintage is this?
This is the... Well, actually, this is the 2018.
18? Because last year, the first in 2021, the first grapes that I tasted of the 2021 vintage were Sharpham's Madeleine Angevin. I saw them. I was down at their new winery.
Yeah, so they've gone across the river now, haven't they?
They've crossed the river into another absolutely spectacular place with the most beautiful views across the Dart. The Dart is a really lovely part of England. And they've got really beautiful sloping vineyards running down to the Dart. Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, but also they've always been good at Madeleine Angevin. And they always make a lovely, soft, bright flavoured wine. But this is 18. Let me taste it.
11%.
The only other time I've ever had a really old Madeleine Angevin has been from Yorkshire.
Oh.
Leventhorpe, where George Bloody Bowden is a professional Yorkshireman, makes Madeleine Angevin, and you like it or lump it. And for about the first 15 years, it tasted of rust and coal dust and industrial decay. And suddenly, about 2005, climate change just came in enough. And from then on, he's been making gorgeous wine. And I had a 15-year-old Madeleine Angevin from him last year. Just an absolute delight. But this is, what, 5 years old?
Yeah, 5 years old. And they've still got that wonderful citrus.
Smells beautiful.
I always go down there in October because we do the Dartmouth Food Festival. And as you said, it's beautiful. I think there's a field just next door to them, which Country Life put on their front cover as the most beautiful field in England.
Well, it'll probably be Pinot Noir in 5 years' time.
Well, he has got some limestone there.
Yeah,
so the winemaker
is
Duncan Schwab. And he is planting some Pinot Noir.
Up on the ridge there, he's got... Yeah. And also, what's lovely about them, they've also planted lots of old Devon cider trees. Mm. I mean, they're dead keen to get it right, I think. And I must say, I went and opened their new winery in 2022. And it was a wonderful day in the most beautiful part of England, tasting Madeleine Angevin. Now, you see this, everyone says it can't age. You've got to have it for 6 months old. This is absolutely delicious. It's lemony. It's got a flavour like green apples, but really ripe green apples, not sour ones, not crab apples. Really ripe, so that they've got the sugar of the ripeness, but kept that lovely crisp green edge to them. Mm. And the lemoniness is like boiled lemons. It's not like a fresh lemon, which would be too sharp. There's something much softer. And then, do you know that whenever I do Madeleine Angevin wines, I feel there's a softness.
Yes.
There's a mellow, fluffy, cotton woolly gentleness, as though it's calming you down. It's saying, I'm okay, I'm a nice, gentle, lovely wine. But this is nearly 5 years old.
Yeah.
I think it's delicious.
And I think you could pair this with hard cheese. This would go really well with the cheese board, actually.
Yeah. Sharpham cheese.
Yeah. But yeah,
Sharpham make very good cheese. Yes. Or a proper cheddar? Would you do it with the cheddar?
Yeah, I think with yes.
Not too old.
No, but it could be
a sort of a middle-aged Montgomery, a middle-aged Quick.
Mm. I'm really enjoying this, actually.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely delicious. Yeah. I noticed that you're spitting, Will.
Yeah.
How responsible. I've forgotten to. Actually, I couldn't find the spittoon, but I see that you've nicked it.
We've got a day of tasting ahead of us.
We've got 8 hours.
And speaking. Now, Oz, we had a bit of a flavour of it, but you were great on screen with the wonderful Judy Gordon.
Yes.
And you had those incredible, colourful tasting notes. And I was wondering if you could sort of give us a flavour of what it was like in those days. Because you had it was almost like the National Theatre, wasn't it? You had, there wasn't the internet.
We had 10 or 12 million people watching us frequently, sometimes more. And we were in small studios around the southwest of London, mostly, or in the west of London. We absolutely knew that there was a massive audience out there, and they were watching us, and they really wanted anybody to give them the chance to drink wine. Because until then, 90% of our audience, our population, had been completely shut out from wine.
Yeah.
And we were saying, we're not shutting you out. We're opening it up. And you can't open up 90% of the population by telling them about malolactic fermentation and how many months in an oak barrel it's been and whether the Cabernet Sauvignon needs another week of ripening. They're not interested. A glass of wine is a glass of wine. You've got to just say, Gilly loves this one, I love this one, that one's red, this one's white, and then take a great slug of it and come out with some explosive coruscating English language. Now, I was more likely to go into the depths of things that might possibly occur in a glass of wine, like, you know, great chunks of my mother's blackcurrant jam slathered over a thick slab of salted butter on still warm, fresh white bread straight out of the baker's oven. And that's the kind of blackcurrant I'm talking about in this Chilean Sauvignon or something. Gilly Goulden, of course, God knows what she was going to turn up with.
But was it tiptoeing naked through a summer meadow?
Was she naked? Or I do remember Gamay,
yes.
Talking about Gamay, and I think I said, oh, gosh, it's got a wonderful taste. It's almost like warm tarmac in summer. And Gilly said, yes, it's more than that. She said, it's like me running in my gym slip with my plimsolls down a warm tarmac road in summer. And you can just see the whole of England held its breath and then tore out to the shops the next morning and said, I want that Gilly Goulden wine. I want the Gilly Goulden wine. And that's what they did. And we used to say, especially when we had difficult names, German names, I said, don't worry about the name. Just you go into Morrison's and say, I want the Oz wine. Or you go into Tesco and say, I want the Gilly wine. And that's what they did. I want the Gilly wine. I want the Oz wine. And Gilly, you never knew what she was going to come up with.
No.
And it could be the... I mean, she was very keen on the bottom of a hamster's cage. I didn't have a hamster. She used to be very keen on babies' bottoms. I didn't have a baby with a bottom. I'm a single boat living in London. What am I supposed to know about babies' bottoms? But people absolutely loved it. And she came out with these bizarre ideas, like this tastes like the grease scraped from the inside of a sumo wrestler's thigh. And you just thought, I'm really worried about that girl's social life.
No, fantastic. Well, you obviously haven't regretted your life in wine. Have you ever thought about going back to the boards? Or?
Well, I still do.
Yeah, you still do a bit, don't you?
I do about 10 shows a year with the Armonica Consort.
Yes.
It's a Baroque music consort. And that's fantastic because I'm out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
It's very frightening being on stage. People think, oh, you must have a wonderful laugh on stage. It's very frightening. And talk to actors and performers and singers. They're always nervous. They're always fretting. Same with great athletes and all the rest.
Yeah.
Going out to perform in public is a very courageous thing to do. I gave up doing it probably because I was losing my nerve.
Yeah.
I was playing General Perron and Evita in London on the West End stage, and I'd done wonderful shows. I'd played Sweeney Todd at Drury Lane.
Yes.
I'd done the Mitford Girls with Patricia Hodge at the Globe. I was doing big stuff.
You were in the first Superman as well.
I was in the first Superman. Yeah, right. I was the first person, Superman 1, ever arrested.
Yeah.
I am the first person to be arrested by Superman. I was a bank robber in it. And he was lovely, Christopher Reeve. And he looked so like Clark Kent. And he was a really lovely guy. Remember, I was talking to him once and I was saying, you must have been so excited when you saw they were going in Superman because you knew you looked exactly like Clark Kent. He said, exactly what I thought. I was so excited. I knew I'd get the job. And I went for the audition. I walked into a room. And there were 50 people who looked exactly like Clark Kent in the room. Obviously, a lot of Americans look exactly like Clark Kent.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful show to do. And I did things. I sang the music for the original Lord of the Rings.
Did you? I didn't know that.
You know, I did all these things, and then I sort of moved into wine.
But wine just pulled you back, always.
Well, I think the theatre may have pushed me away slightly.
Yes.
And also the crucial thing was I thought I needed a bit of a break. I'd done 10 years without a break in the theatre, and that's not usual. And you wear out.
Yeah.
And I think that when BBC Food and Drink happened, I suddenly realised I had a massive audience again.
Yeah.
And I could act and I could perform. And even if I could only see the camera, I knew that in the bowels of that camera, there were millions and millions of people desperate to hear what I was going to say about wine, and therefore desperate to hear what I was going to say about enjoying life, and desperate to hear what I was going to say about throwing off the shackles of classdom and throwing off the shackles of wine snobbery and standing up and saying, me too, I'm a wine drinker, I'm happy to be a wine drinker. And that's what Gillian and I set out to do.
I thought we'd talk a little bit about blind tasting. Although it's the 50th anniversary of the Sunday Times Wine Club, it's also the 70th anniversary of the Oxford v Cambridge Blind Wine Tasting Society.
My God, is it?
Yeah, fixture, which, you know, takes place every year. But I know, Oz, that you've done it quite successfully on television as well.
And I've done the Oxford Cambridge.
And you, of course,
I won it.
Well, we were, let's not go into what year that was.
I won it for Oxford rather than Cambridge, you'll be pleased to hear. But yes, and I did do it on television, and I did it on television every year. And it was a much easier, I'll say, to do it when I was doing it because there were far less good wines.
Yeah.
There are now so many good wines that too many wines taste similar to each other. They didn't when I was doing it.
Yeah.
But what when I was teaching people wine tasting, and I would say the same now, is first impressions.
Yeah.
Because I always used to say to myself, I've got a good memory. If I've tasted it, there's a reasonable chance I'll remember it. That was in the days when you might taste 20 wines a week. Now, if you taste, you know, 150 wines a day, it's a bit more difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
But first impression, it's amazing how often that works. And today in the show, several times I've been talking to people about blind wine tasting and where do you start? And I've said, first impressions. And they said, yes, it's surprising how often I'm right, even though I've moved away from being right. And I always say to people, three times out of four, if you've ever tasted a wine, something flashes through your brain. And three times out of four, it'll be the right decision. So don't change your mind unless you've really got a strong reason to.
Yeah.
Now, there are some wines which are easy to taste blind. You might say New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is easy to taste blind. You might say a Riesling from the Mosel Valley in Germany is easy to taste blind. You might well say, I don't know, a Châteauneuf du Pape or something. But that's because they've got very defined characters. But an enormous number of wines around the world no longer have those defined characters. And it genuinely is difficult to get them right.
I agree.
And please, when you're blind tasting, remember it's a game.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a game. Don't let it upset your evening. People make me blind taste quite often, and I say to people, right, I'm putting a time limit on this, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And they expect 10 or 15 minutes of waffle from me. And I said, if 10 or 15 minutes of waffle, we'll have finished the bottle by the time we finish, and we still won't have had any fun.
Yeah.
Because blind tasting is intellectual. It's not great fun. When we did it on television in those early days, in front of 10 or 12 million people watching you in their dressing room, everyone in their drawing room or their front room saying, is he going to mess up this time? It's high pressure.
Yeah.
And I could do it because there weren't many wine tastings to go to and there weren't many wines which stood out in those tastings. And often they sent me wines they thought, this will be really difficult because we haven't heard of it before, i.e. New Zealand or an Australian Chardonnay or a Chilean Carmenere. The point is, since there weren't many of them, if there were any on the market, I would have tasted them.
Yeah.
My first time I had to do a blind wine tasting on television, there were only two Australian Chardonnays in the British market.
That's incredible.
And I looked at this wine, which was thick and golden and rich and viscous, and without even tasting it, I said, that's an Australian Chardonnay, and it's got to be Tyrrell's or Rosemount, because they're the only two there are.
Yeah.
And by the time I got down to it, I made the right choice, and I got 100%. Everyone thought I was a genius. I wasn't a genius. I was just lucky.
Well, I tell you what, we're not going to blind taste this. If we're thinking about the two most exciting wine-producing countries in the world at the moment, I think there's a good argument for Portugal, but there's an even better argument for South Africa. And this is coming on to our second wine. This is what we have in our glass. So we're traveling 8,000 miles. And South Africa, at every price point, I think, just delivers value.
Yeah.
And I've been saying today, maybe it's because they don't have much of a market in America. The Americans haven't woken up to the fact that we have these great wines.
I think that is true, that there are some areas that South Africa has not managed to catch on.
Yeah.
But it has managed to catch on for us in Britain. And they send us very, very good South African wine here. And I think it's value for money is outstanding.
Yeah.
I think there's a new generation which changes every time I go there.
Yeah.
You're away for 3 days, three years. I mean, you come back, and well, maybe 3 days, but you come back 3 years later. And there's a whole bunch of new people. What's inspiring is also that there's an enormous number of head winemakers aged about 30. And a lot of them now are women. And a generation ago, hardly any of them were women. And now a lot of them are. That's really important because however old-fashioned it sounds to say this, men and women taste things differently.
Yeah.
And the men and women are fundamentally different, thank God,
yeah.
And will have different psychological, chemical, physical attitudes to what's happening in the glass, or how to make the wine, or what they think is an attractive attribute in a wine. So the fact that South Africa's now got so many good women, again, really young on the whole, is inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, one of the things that South Africa does so well is Chardonnay. Yeah. This great grape that has been badly, badly abused by a lot of people, not only around the world, but also wine drinkers will say, oh, I don't like Chardonnay. Or wine writers will say, oh, Chardonnay's rubbish. You know, it's not fair. Chardonnay's a tremendous grape.
Well, I always say that, you know, the world's most expensive white wine is Morichet, which is a Chardonnay. Now, this is in our glass here. We have the Harrison Chardonnay for the Vineyard Partners.
And Hérisson means hedgehog.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, this lovely guy called Adam Mason, it's after those things that they dry bottles in. You know that in France, you've got these metal sticks with lots of prongs, which look like hedgehogs when they've got bottles on them. That's why he called it Hérisson. Don't ask me why he didn't choose 1,000 other words. But he's an interesting guy because he started winemaking. His first job was at Laithwaite's after he got out of Stellenbosch University. He worked all over Europe and I think outside Europe with Jean-Marc Saubourg. Then, having learnt tons, went back, and within 2 years, he was the winemaker, the chief winemaker at Clain Constantia, one of the most respected, prestigious jobs in the whole of Africa, just 2 years after he'd come back. And he was making things like seminal, outstanding Sauvignon Blancs and Semillons. Also, he was making Vin de Constance.
Yeah.
The great, the wine that 300 or 400 years ago was one of the most famous wines in the world.
Yeah.
And he then went to Mulderbosch and he then went to Morganzon. They're all outstanding white wine producers. And I think he said that, and a lot of people have said this, finding the silver lining in COVID. COVID made him sit back and think, and you couldn't go and see anybody and you couldn't go on sales trips or anything. And he thought, I really, really want to do my own thing. And so he's gone into an area in Stellenbosch, and you think, oh, Stellenbosch, isn't that a red wine area? Well, it is. It's probably one of the best Cabernet Sauvignon areas in the world. But there are many parts of the Stellenbosch area which are famous for Chardonnay, where they're a bit colder, where they're a bit higher, where the soils are a little bit different. And here he is tucked underneath the Stellenbosch mountains, just to the south of the town. And he's making a delicious, delicious wine. He's using oak barrels, but they're old oak barrels. He's using the wild yeast that he's found in his own vineyards. He does this thing called whole bunch pressing, which means that you throw all the bunches into old-fashioned presses, the stems and everything, and gently press down on them. And all the gunk, the leaves and the stems, and everything, they sort of act as a sieve. They mean that the juice that comes out is much purer. A lot of the heavy stuff has been caught on the stems and things. It's a really good, all the great Burgundies do it that way. And you come up with a wine which is pure as anything. Lovely fruit. It's such good fruit, it almost tastes sweet.
Yeah.
It's bone dry. And the aftertaste is wonderfully savoury, not in a silly winemakery sulfide way, which we all got so tired of, those sulfide wines that tasted like battery acid and winemakers and sommeliers told us they were the best in the world. They weren't. But this is like a beautifully salted, fresh, freshly roasted hazelnut or something. And I think that the blend is inspiring. And this is his first wine.
Yeah.
Wax and good old Laithwaite's, because it's a partner.
It's a partner.
It's a partner.
Well, I mean, time is always the enemy, and I think we've got to go back on stage in a minute. So I was just wondering, what's your best parting words of advice for our listeners when it comes to drinking wine, if you had anything?
Be adventurous.
Be adventurous.
Be in a good mood when you drink wine. Buy wines that make you smile.
Yes.
Buy wines that make your eyes sparkle, that make you feel witty and sexy and nice to know. Never be frightened of a new thing.
Yeah.
Don't just stick with what you know. And when somebody tries to tell you that you're wrong, It's your palate. It's your sense of smell and taste. It's your hangover.
Yeah.
You're never wrong. Whatever. If you're honest with yourself, you're never wrong.
Wonderful. Words of advice. Well, thanks, Oz. It's been wonderful to catch up. Cheers.
Well, that's it from today. Thank you very much for listening to this bonus episode of Wine Times in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. Produced by Chris Denman. The series producer is Anya Pierce. We'll be back soon with a brand new series of Wine Times where I'll be joined by a new co-host and partner in wine. So make sure you hit that follow button wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. From Oz and myself here at the Vintage Wine Festival at London's Olympia, thank you very much for listening, and we hope to see you soon for more Wine Times.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.